Hello, this is Donna Seaman welcoming you to Open Books, an hour-long conversation about outstanding books, remarkable writers, and the fine art of reading. Today, I'm honored to have as our guest Mary Gordon, author of 8 works of fiction, including Final Payments, The Other Side, The Rest of Life, Spending, and her newest novel, Pearl. Mary Gordon has also written 4 works of nonfiction, including 2 powerful memoirs, The Shadow Man and Seeing Through Places, and A Portrait of Joan of Arc. Welcome.
Thank you.
I couldn't help but be curious when I was reading Pearl as to how this novel related to your research on Joan of Arc.
Well, I actually started this novel in 1997, and I was very interested. I mean, I seem to be interested in a lot of things, which is why it took me so long to write it, trying to get them all in. But among the things I was interested in was the figure of a young woman that I call a sort of Antigone type, which is a young woman who is willing to give everything, including her life, for what she believes is an important idea or an important cause. So as I was writing that, the editor, James Atlas of the Penguin series, called up and said, would you like to do a biography of somebody? And in 1 second, it came to me, Joan of Arc.
Perfect.
So the two of them really did weave in and out of one another because of this interest in the young woman who will give everything.
And that is Pearl.
Yes.
Who we discover right away on Christmas, via her mother's answering machine, that Pearl, who's a college student in Dublin, has gone on a hunger strike and chained herself to a flagpole at the American Embassy.
Yes.
Dramatic opening.
Yeah. I wanted to just get you right in the action. She's in Dublin, but she's American.
Right.
She's just there.
And she's not Irish.
She's not Irish.
No.
She has no Irish roots, as opposed to everybody else in America, but
right.
She actually doesn't.
And no, her background's very interesting,
yes,
actually.
Yes.
It's a big part of the story.
Yes. And I wanted to, her background is that her mother is Jewish. Her father was Cambodian, somebody who came over in the time of Pol Pot to try to draw attention to those atrocities and then disappeared back into the nightmare that was Cambodia. So she never knew him. And I'm very interested in you know, this new America, this new world that we're in which national identity is increasingly delusional and so therefore increasingly prized. The reality is that we're much more mixed on the planet than we ever were. And so some sort of dream of purity, expressing itself in pure race or pure blood, seems to be very important in the world. And a theme that underlies a lot of this book is, it seems to me, the misplaced desire for a kind of purity, which I think only leads to death. The link between purity and death was important to me. And yet, if we think about purity in the sense of giving everything, the artist has to be pure. The hero has to be pure. So I was trying to figure out, and I'm not sure that I did, what we can do with this impulse to purity to try to uncouple it from the impulse to death.
That's so fascinating. The book, I mean, you get at that, and many of your novels revolve around that question of purity, religion and art, how those two interact, and the idea of compassion and empathy. I mean, Pearl, you know, goes to Ireland, finds out about Bobby Sands, a martyr who died through a hunger strike, feels, you know, stricken that she's been protected, that these people have been suffering. She feels complicit in a death. And so you raise all these questions about responsibility, about altruism, you know, how can you do good in the world? Mm. How do you affect change? You know, what is your life worth versus someone else's life? Very difficult stuff. And each of the 3 characters embroiled in this, Maria the mother, Pearl the daughter, and Joseph, a very interesting character.
Yes, I have great sympathy and love for Joseph.
Yes.
And I think he might be a difficult spice for some people to take into their palate. But I felt very tender toward him.
Oh, I think he's being profoundly interested in art, anyone that's inspired by Ruskin and concerned with, you know, purity of art versus experience interests me very much. And his moral dilemmas are, you know, multidimensional.
I also wanted to, you know, I'm not a 60s basher. I, every day in my life, I go down on my knees and thank God that I came of age in the 60s, which seemed to me, it's not that we weren't deeply foolish in some ways and quite mistaken in others. Nevertheless, it seemed to me a time of openness and hopefulness and energy that is gone from the world. But I'm also very aware, having been brought up working class, that the 60s had a real class valence to them.
Yeah.
So if you were working class, you might not have been having the same 60s as middle class people.
That's
and
right.
In Joseph was, to me, the type of the scholarship boy who didn't really have the margin to experiment because he believed that in 1 foot off the rung of the ladder and he's just, you know, in the pit again. So I was very interested in a man, a working class man, who is really trying to be good. And that kind of man often just breaks my heart because I often think there's really no point to being a man if you want to be good. Then you only suffer like a woman. No, the men who don't suffer are people who are just, you know, are completely selfish.
Oblivious.
But men who are concerned about being good, really, it's much more difficult for them. And so I'm always very moved by that kind of man because I think they, in a way, they're more alone in their struggles than women are.
What a profound observation. His situation, the way you set it up, is you know, it's complicated in so many ways. Maria's father is another complicated figure, one of your many converts. The theme runs through your books of a Jew that converts to Catholicism. And Joseph is Maria's father's housekeeper's son. And those two are raised sort of as brother and sister.
Yes.
Until a nun objects to this proximity.
Yes.
Interesting breaks with faith, that different phases of Maria's life, too. But he ends up inheriting her father's business, which is a perfect Mary Gordon business, a religious art business.
Well, that was so much fun for me. I have Maria's father made a fortune, actually, in the business of selling religious articles.
I love how you have him, that he has good taste, and he's appalled at how schlocky most religious articles are.
Yeah, it was the ultimate research topic for me because it involved two things, schlock and Rome. I really had to go to Rome. What else could I do?
You
poor
had
me.
To.
And there's a whole district in Rome near the Piazza Minerva where it's just the religious article district, and it just, you know, it's like the Disney World of religious art. And you just, you know, you walk into one window and there's a 30-foot statue of the Pope, and it's, oh my God, you know, he's gonna get me. And it was a real window into the changing culture of the church. Objects that would not appeal to my cohort or my mother's, but, you know, a church increasingly third world.
Yes.
And so what little artifacts are they going to buy? A church impacted upon by television.
Uh-huh.
What artifacts does that spawn? And then I had a fabulous time going through the catalogs of religious art in America, which is just a hoot. And, you know, I could have written, I really had to control myself not to spend a whole 50 pages on the religious article business. But it also seemed to me, you know, again, a place where the desire for beauty,
yes,
and piety and class come into play in a very direct way.
That's right. It's interesting, you know, Joseph, for him, beauty is sort of a religion. I mean,
yes,
it's a faith, and yet it fails him over and over again. The story of his marriage is, you know, the perfect example of religion versus art. You know, codes of behavior versus sensuality and expressiveness.
Yes.
Deborah is an Orthodox Jew who has a beautiful voice, a gift. And you use her story, or the conflict she comes to discover within herself about being an artist versus just being a regular person.
Yes. One of my gifts and problems in life is that I seem to have, however small, only one talent. I love music. I have no musical talent. I love painting. I have really no talent for any of the visual arts. So I really, and yet the what interests me is the differences and similarities in the art forms. Mm. So the life of a singer has always been very evocative for me because it's so physical.
Right.
In a way that writing isn't. I mean, you really can write till you're 110. And you can't sing past a certain age.
Like dancing.
Yes. Yeah. And what I've learned from my singer and musician friends is to be a singer, you always have to watch out for yourself because your body is your instrument. And
right.
So you can't get a cold. You can't do this. You can't get too tired. And so the person who protects the singer also has to have a curtailed life. And at one point, Devorah says, you know, it's not worth it. I'm not good enough. And that's always a moment that interests me. I was just reading this and teaching this fabulous story by Bernard Malamud, whom I adore, called Rembrandt's Hat. And it's about an artist who understands that he's not very good. And so that moment in the life of an artist always interests me because in movies and books about the artist, it's always about the good artist. And,
yes.
You know, if it's a painter, he's throwing paint on the canvas and throwing the canvas down. But in the end, it's wonderful.
Right.
And if he's a musician, he's sweating and pulling his hair. But in the end, he's in Carnegie Hall. And if it's a writer, the wastebasket is full of paper. But in the end, she writes War and Peace. But what about the artist who comes to the moment and says, you know, it's just not good enough. I'm not good enough. And that's the moment that Devorah comes to. And Joseph, who has staked his whole life on her gift, feels terribly betrayed by that decision to live an ordinary life.
That's right. Incredibly poignant. And he goes another step, which resonates very strongly with me, so for a lot of reasons. She takes to gardening.
Yes.
And he's appalled. You know, why would you garden? And there's a quote in the book where he actually says that to him, a poem or a painting about a garden is much more important than a garden.
Yes.
And here's where, you know, art becomes a distortion and an aberration.
Yes.
Instead of a saving power.
And I was very, I'm also very moved and heartbroken by the character of Ruskin, whom I invoke, who's somebody who just couldn't choose life over art ever. And was in the end driven mad by his own, again, hyper-idealism. And so those kinds of characters really are very poignant to me.
That's such a deep level to work on. You know, I really marvel over, in all your novels, and especially in Pearl, how much goes on every page. And, you know, in rereading this book, I thought, well, now how does Mary Gordon do this? I mean, there's a real storyline. I mean, it's not all ideas. It's not all about, you know, philosophical matters. There's very earthy mother-daughter conflicts and a larger picture, a real global consciousness about compassion and compassion fatigue, I would call it, as well. And then there's Ruskin, and then there's all these details. So I wonder how does it work? Do you see the largest arc of the story first, or the characters?
Well, this book was particularly difficult to write, which is why it took me 7 years to write it. And I'll just answer that question by saying what Post-its I had on my desk. And I had three Post-its. One said coarseness, one said malignity, and one said fatigue. And I had those on my desk, on the wall by my desk, and my daughter came in and said, "Having a bad day, Mom?" And anyway, just to go back a little bit, the characters of Maria and Joseph had their genesis in a story that I wrote in 1985. I wrote a story about them as children, about this relationship between the son of the housekeeper and the daughter of the house.
Right.
And how that would, you know, what that would be like. So they've really been in my mind for a very long time, those two characters.
Interesting.
And then I think I've been concerned about this Antigone figure and concerned about what does a young woman, an idealistic young woman, do with her idealism in a generation in which there's no public place for that. In our generation, I'm 55, there was a place to act out your idealism in the world and with others.
Yeah.
And so I wondered what would happen to those impulses in this generation. And then I was with a great friend of mine who's been very involved in Irish politics, and we're actually sitting in the Frick. And he told me a story of friends, the son of friends of his. They were professionals. This kid was a real loser. He was the family loser. And what he did was to try to get the attention of the most radical ring of the IRA, he placed a bomb on a golf course and, in fact, went to jail. Meanwhile, the IRA had no interest in him.
Right.
So I found out from this friend that there's a whole cohort of young Irish people who fantasize about the glory days of the IRA in the way that some kids in America fantasize about the Vietnam era or being hippies.
Right.
So then that interested me, and I wanted to write about the world because the world seems increasingly dark and hopeless making to me. Anyway, all those things came together, and the question was how to blend them, and so I have a trunk full, a literal trunk full of rewrites. And the other post that I had on my desk next to coarseness, malignity, and fatigue, which were the three things that my characters feared.
Right.
I had a post-it saying, remember, it's a story. And so originally, the structure of the book was each of the characters had very long dramatic monologues. And I realized that that wasn't moving the story along. So after many years, and this is an accident, I was both teaching E.M. Forster's Howard's End and writing an introduction to an edition of it. And the narrator, Howard's End, came to me, and I thought, oh, look at what Forster does. He does all this stuff I'm trying to do. It's really a book of ideas, but you never feel oppressed by the ideas. But right. In Howard's End, there's what is England, what is class, what is marriage, what is art. Ruskin also figures in Howard's End. And I thought, oh, God, I'll steal his narrator.
Huh.
And I chose then a narrator who is not part of the action, but that moves the action along.
That is one of the most interesting narrators I've come across in recent fiction. A very complicated voice.
Yes, and some people really, really hate it.
Had a hard time with it.
So I just have to, given the fact that I want everybody to love me totally, 24/7.
Yes, it never works.
I can't understand why these people don't love my narrator.
Well, I can't understand either because I found, immediately there's this, the narrator won't even let you know if it's a he or a
yes,
she.
Yes.
I mean, that's the first thing. It's like not given that away.
Yeah.
And then the narrator's telling the reader, I don't know. I don't understand. I mean, so it's a very unusual, it's not exactly omniscient.
No.
And it's not exactly happy about the whole thing.
No. And I think I wanted to, I guess I've become a sort of postmodernist kicking and screaming. But the notion that the writer doesn't completely control the character, that the character then surprises the writer, which I guess was a sort of metaphor for my trying to understand late in life, or later in life, that I don't control my fate, my children's fate, the fate of the world, in the way that I had hoped when I was younger. And so, although I'm not of the school that says there is no such thing as the author, I did understand that at certain point my characters just don't behave the way that I wish they would behave, and they'll say, no, I'm doing it. In the same way that when children say, no, I'm doing this. I'm not yours completely. So
well,
I was slightly playing with that.
And that is exactly what goes on between Maria and Pearl.
Yes.
I mean, Maria's baffled. What did I do wrong? How could my daughter, risk her life? And, of course, Pearl's motives are unclear. It seems that she's being suicidal rather than trying to make a statement. And there's a point where Maria's thinking, well, perhaps mothers never know their daughters yeah. as well as they think they do.
Yes.
And so the narrator's that way too. It's telling the reader, well, perhaps narrators don't know the book as well as you want them to.
Yes.
It's happening before their eyes also.
Another idea or problem in the world that I wanted to explore was the mother-daughter knot.
Yes.
The adult of the adult daughter who creates a different set of issues for the mother. And it seems to me, of all the family relationships, the mother-daughter one is the most vexed. and this idea of a loving mother that she doesn't really know her daughter at all. And how can that have happened? And the character of Maria, whom I, again, have great affection for, who's just sort of a, you know, she's just an action person.
Yes.
And if she doesn't understand it, she'll just crash through it. Having this daughter who is really a contemplative. So in the old Catholic division, it's the vita activa as opposed to the vita contemplativa. So you have this mother that's just going to ram her head through whatever wall is there, and a daughter that would just like to sit and be quiet and figure it out before she moves.
Right.
And those interesting things that can happen between mothers and daughters where their natures are just quite different. And although there's great love, there can be also great misunderstanding. And the task of mothers and daughters to separate and then to come back together, one hopes, is one of the most difficult journeys, I think, in life.
Yeah, that's beautifully put and very strongly evoked in the novel. You go back to both their pasts as well. And over the course of reading Pearl, I kept, you know, writing little notes to myself going, well, see, here it's nature, not nurture.
Yeah.
The Pearl's inheritances that she's unaware of are motivating her.
Yes. And it is a question that, obviously I'm not the only one that thought of this, but you see with children, they come up with things that you couldn't possibly have given them.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, they come up with things that you tried to keep them from or keep them away from. And so the question is it DNA or were they picking up some, you know, tune in the universe that you don't hear? On the other hand, the nurture does come through in the end, so that if you were, you know, a jerk about something, the child will probably suffer from that. And if you were good about something, it might bear fruit in ways that you didn't expect as a parent.
Yeah. That's very interesting. And there's another mother and child relationship in the story that's very affecting. In Ireland, this young woman, Breda, sort of a unwilling mother, as Maria sort of was. I mean, these are accidental,
yes,
unmarried situations. So you explore that, those different sort of connections and love and the guilt that goes into trying to raise a child under strange circumstances.
Yeah, one reviewer said that I was the great poet of guilt and regret. Oh, gee. What a wonderful thing to be known as in the world. That'll make people run out and buy the book. But I guess they're some of my big themes.
Yes, but right next to beauty and refinement versus coarseness, I mean, that those are some really subtle things, but within a very complicated story.
Yeah.
I wonder if at this point in our discussion, because I want to talk a little bit more about your writing style, if you'd like to read something from Pearl.
Sure. Let me just situate it a bit, if I may. Maria, who is Pearl's mother, gets a call, as you said, on Christmas night that her daughter has chained herself to the flagpole. And Maria feels that she has to go over to Ireland and try to keep her daughter alive. And so the passage that I'm going to read occurs when Maria is on the plane, which is a nightmare for her because she can't do anything. She's sort of trapped in the air, and her daughter's dying, and she can't do anything. And it is connected to a lot of her feelings about being a mother. In the confusion brought about by her fatigue, it takes Maria a while to determine that the noise her brain is trying to respond to is the sound of a child crying. It is an economy. There are no babies visible in first class. She wonders if babies aren't allowed in first class and is prepared to be outraged for that. She has no evidence that babies aren't allowed in first class, only what she knows of the world from working for 20 years with children, the false claims of allegiance to the young and the real failures to provide for them make her think it's possible that babies are excluded from first class. Thinking it's possible, she quickly moves to believing it is really the case. Outrage is strikeable in her, a flint always ready to catch fire, and the actual potential or remembered treatment of children is always able to inspire her outrage. Our children, people say, but she knows they mean only their own, only the ones who live in their houses or similar ones. My treasure, her father had called her, and it made her bristle. Treasure to be protected, hidden, like his 14th century French ivories, his icons of the Madonna. When she was a teenager, she said to him, I want a world where everyone's children are as important as our own. And her father had said, that's impossible. It's against the natural law. The natural law. It was something Seymour Myers invoked to justify all kinds of tyrannies. But now, flying to her daughter who is at the edge of death, she knows he was right. If someone said to her, choose, you must choose right this moment. We will sacrifice 100 children to keep your child alive. What would she say? She knows what she would say, and she knows what it means about her. She has cast her lot with those who say my own and mean something connected to themselves, the radius of the circle that surrounds their own bodies, nothing larger, nothing as large as the whole world. The baby's cry breaks up these thoughts. Her eyes fall on the frantic baby. The mother is young and overwhelmed. She has two other children. Maria calculates their ages, 3 and 4. They are tugging at their mother, trying to call on her as she tries futilely. To comfort the infant. Maria sees that the mother is not much older than Pearl, and she is filled with the kind of desperate tenderness that often comes over her in the course of her work at the sight of a young mother in despair. She makes a quick calculation. How can she offer help without suggesting to the mother that she is a failure at the thing all successful women are born knowing how to do? She touches the young woman's shoulder. The young woman jerks her head toward Maria, ready to defend herself, ready for a rebuke. Hello, Maria says. I don't mean to intrude, but you seem to have your hands full, and I'm bored out of my skull. I run a daycare center, and I'm used to crying children. Why don't you let me walk the baby up the aisle, and you can pay attention to the other kids and get a little break yourself? The mother, Maria is right. She's very young, begins to cry. I couldn't ask you, she says. Maria hears that she is Irish. Believe me, you'd be doing me a favor. I love babies, and I hate sitting still. The woman hands the baby over, along with a bottle and a blanket and a rattle. The baby is 6 months old. Maria doesn't know its name or sex. It is simply a child in distress. Maria clasps the baby to her, and the long drowning that began when she first held Pearl, the remembered swoon that comes over her when she holds a baby, is now hers. She puts her mouth to the baby's skull and breathes in the milky salt. Walking the baby, feeling its dampish warmth at the front of her body, its heaviness against her chest, she thinks of Pearl's babyhood, of the day of her birth, after the mess and blood and shouting and pushing were over, and she heard it's a girl and thought, thank God. When she was in the recovery room with her clean, wrapped baby, alone with her for the first time, she knew that never in her life would she need anyone as she needed Pearl. Alone with her, her baby, mine. Nothing had ever been so quiet, nothing had ever been so purely sufficient to itself. A perfect circle, a circle as pure and powerful as the white host. Miraculous, mysterious, common as dirt. She knew that in that moment she had more in common with any woman who had just given birth, with the most venal Hollywood starlet, with the wife of the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, than she did with her closest friend. Tentatively, Pearl put her mouth to her mother's breast, both of them inexpert. Only later would the urgency of real hunger strike. For now, they were alone and silent. "Hello, my own," Maria said to Pearl. She has been saying that to her with every sentence since that moment, believing what Pearl does not believe, that no one will ever know her so well, and that she will never be known so well. "I am the beloved, and the beloved is mine." The ellipse of the most ecstatic sex is ragged, partial, next to this moment of knowing I am known. The greatest passion of her life seizes her when she first holds her baby. It is not gentle, not at all. It is violent, a violent predatory bird with a strong, sharp beak that lifts her, exhilarated over treetops, swirls her dangerously, dangles her, turns her over and over, sometimes allowing her to soar in the plain ecstasy of sheer flight. The predator bird, mother love. She cannot explain it to anyone, this power and danger, the danger of being taken up entirely, whirled who knows where, then dropped just anywhere at all. Why, she wonders, do people think that mother love is peaceful? The soaring and the drowning, the terror, the exaltation, the sharp bites of the beak in the soft skin at the back of the neck, it has not claimed its proper language. The mystic, her skin melted by the touch of God, the lover set aflame at the sight of the beloved, these are nothing compared to her flight in the beak of this predatory bird. My own, you had to say it, you could not keep from saying it. And yet children are not your own. For a while you think they are, as you clasp them safe, and then, how does it happen? They have somehow wriggled free, and they are riding on the bird's back now, and the direction of the flight is in their hands. They ride, unreachable by you, heads in the clouds, while you are dangled, while the beak bites harder now into your neck. "You can't get me," they shout, intoxicated by the height, their hair wind-blown, their cheeks burnished, unaware of the danger you can see from your lower position, closer to the ground. "I am not yours," they say, and then the beak shakes you, turns you over, shows you how far, how devastatingly it would be possible to fall. Nothing has ever been more powerful, nothing has ever been more dangerous. And it takes her entirely by surprise. She hadn't been one of those girls who played with dolls, who dreams of hordes of children. She hadn't even meant to get pregnant. But she is never happier in her life than when Pearl is a baby, a small child. The exhaustion, the boredom, the cub's lapses, these are nothing compared to the drowning joy.
Beautiful. Thank you. That's Mary Gordon reading from Pearl. Very intense. And she's on this really, the book takes place over very few days for
yes.
all its great reach.
Yes.
She's on her way to a hospital to see Pearl.
Yes.
And Joseph joins them.
Yes.
Quite something. It's interesting as they converge together in their odd little patched together family. Very private. Things are going on, but also very public concerns. And you work back and forth from that quite a bit, you know, reminding us of the Irish troubles and suffering, reminding us of Cambodia. You ask at one point, does anyone remember
yeah.
these things? And you wrote this book before and after September 11.
I really had to understand after September 11 that there were certain issues that would not be received in the same way that they would have been if I had published it in 1998.
Right.
And one of those was the whole issue of martyrdom.
Right.
And so in 1998, only a few wackos like me, who had the particular kind of Catholic background I did, were thinking about martyrdom. And suddenly, with suicide bombers, martyrdom became an issue in the public consciousness and something that would be received very unsympathetically, more unsympathetically than it would have been on September 10th, 2001. And although there's a great difference between someone who takes her own life and
yes.
someone who takes the lives of others, and I understood that, one of the things that I had to also understand and why I needed my narrator was that there would be just a resistance to the idea of this kind of notion that your life is not the most important thing, in the same way that I believe suicide bombers believe that their lives are not the most important thing. So I had to rethink that and re-understand it in the middle of writing this book. But one of the things that also became more vivid to me in the wake of 9/11 was how some people really don't want peace. And how violence is something that gives meaning to a certain kind of life. And I have to say, I think it's a certain kind of male life, that there seems to be a romance of violence in the world that's very despair-inducing to me. That there seems to be, and again, I'm not smart enough to know whether it's nature or nurture, that there seems to be something in human beings that likes violence, that likes punishment, that likes retribution, and it's very, very strong. And Pearl feels that, and she feels that it's so strong that the only thing she can do is to give her life in witness to it, because her death, she believes, is much stronger than her life would be as a vehicle of witness.
Oh, that's so interesting to contemplate all those things, because, of course, you know, martyrdom goes is as ancient as worship. And the question of the self, you know, where does the self begin and end, and what is your, you know, do you owe society something? Does society owe you something? You know, it's like the opposite ways of looking at things. And, of course, Pearl's naive in a lot of ways.
Yes.
And she finds she's a stranger in a strange land and takes on all these questions on her frail self.
Yes.
Thus enabling you to, you know, remind us that, as you say, violence is... it is part of human nature, and you know, it's really how history works. History is based on violence. That's what you read about. That's what you keep track of and know the dates of. And you know, after September 11 and the war in Iraq, and the fact that innocents now die in war, war really is against innocents, not armies.
Yes.
And so that is something that Pearl's having to face, that she's seen a death that she feels responsible for. And I mean, it's so much murkier than the romantic versions of revolution would have it, or the history of warfare.
And I'm very interested in always in that murkiness, that we seem to have some dream of clarity.
Yeah.
And I don't know where it comes from, because it doesn't come from life. And that's a very great mystery to me. Why do we have this desire for clarity, unity, purity, when nothing in experience gives us the model for it? And again, I'm very touched by young women or young people like Pearl, because if they don't have this naive vision of, you know, how terrible the world is and how yet it might be changed, where are we? Then we're all just in our Hummers driving to the mall. And that doesn't seem like a good option to me either. So I think if you excise idealism and purity, then you get suburbia, forgive me, which I suppose has its own charms. But then you get a shopping mall or Disney World. And that's not enough for human beings either. It just doesn't seem to be. And yet, so much idealism leads to death and violence. So it's not like I have any answers, but I just, those questions are very tormenting to me.
Well, and they're, you know, it's what we need to face. It's so interesting to me to hear you talk about that desire for purity and clarity. You know, I think of it as this need for simplicity, that things are black or white, wrong or right. And, you know, that's what religion plays into so much. And of course, you know, we're living in a time where religion has become
Well, it's where bad religion plays into. Good religion brings you back to the heart of mystery and complication. And I think that's what's so anguishing to me about what the religious right does. I mean, it really gives God a very bad name.
Yes.
Not that he doesn't have one on his own, but or her, but it doesn't help. And it seems to me that if you read the scriptures, they're extremely contradictory.
Yes.
And you can go to the Bible for anything. You know, it can justify slavery, it can justify
sexism,
or it can justify, you know, the most altruistic, loving vision of the world. And so I don't know what these people think the Bible is. They're just not very good readers, paradoxically, although they're people of the book. they're not good readers.
Exactly.
And I understand the anguish of feeling the world is overwhelming. And I think that's where we are now. People feel overwhelmed.
Yes.
And they're scared. And of course I understand that. But the manipulation of that fear is, it seems to me, a very malign thing. And the question that I don't know to the answer to is, what do we do with a world that overwhelms and terrifies us? How do we have hope rather than a desire to punish? Because it seems to me those are the two poles, hope and punishment. And hope is very dangerous. It's very frightening, and it can be extremely disappointing. Punishment is usually fun.
Right.
And if you happen to be on the other
on
side
the other
of punishment.
Right. If you have the whip hand.
Yeah. Yes. And there's a real jolt to it. It's a real kick. And I think that's what violence is about. There's a kick to it. Whereas hope and compassion are very painful. So how do we create a world in which hope and compassion are more possible, given the fact that there are people of violence who do want to hurt us? I don't know, but
exactly.
These are the questions I don't like to think about. I'd rather think about, you know, walking around Rome on a sunny day, but these are the questions that seem to come to me.
And it seems, you know, fiction, to my mind, is the forum for working these out.
Yes.
I mean, it's so, to be able to imagine another person's mind, you know, how a psyche works and how emotions and thoughts come together and, you know, make things more complicated or stark. And you do that so well.
Well, it seems to me that fiction is the opposite of the soundbite.
Yes.
As a form. And what fiction says to you is, it's this way, it's that way, and it's the middle of these two things, and possibly another 100 ways you hadn't thought of it, and here they all are. And I think that's why fiction is one of our great hopes. And it makes me sad that fiction seems to be not what people are reading now, or not the kind of fiction that I wish that they would read. And so much of the fiction that's popular now, both on the high and low end, is either set in the past,
yes,
or set in another world. And I guess I was trying in this book to say, this is where we are now. And can we use fiction just to describe the circles that we're running in?
It's interesting when you were talking about people, you know, are bad readers, the way they read the Bible and take it literally. I think that, I worry about this a lot because I believe that literature is sort of our wellspring of compassion and thought and ability to entertain opposing ideas at the same time.
And yet, people who are good readers are not necessarily better livers. If
that's
that were
right.
The case, every English department in the world would be, you know, just wonderful, full of people who are compassionate and generous.
That's
and
right.
Matter of fact, they're mostly eating each other's livers out. And so that's a grief to me, too, that theoretically fiction, which should make people more generous and compassionate, doesn't always. And some of these people who are terrible readers and reading the Bible appallingly might be people of great generosity and compassion. And I wish that weren't the case.
right.
Again, I wish things fell into categories in a way that I could comprehend them better, and they just don't.
They just don't. Well, in Pearl, you really address that quite a bit. I mean, you show us the extremes where, you know, you can, art can become a malevolent force.
Yes.
Because it'll deny life.
Yes.
And, you know, being a Philistine means that you're closed to everything and that you develop a lot of prejudices. So
yes.
It's, you know, that constant kind of one extreme to the next.
Yes.
And that with over the course of a person's life, they can experience all those points of view.
Yeah.
It's complicated, but I still feel that to follow through a thoughtful, idea-filled novel is good for you, whether it makes you a better person or not. I think it's important, you know, a form of sort of lifelong learning and meditation.
I think so too, and yet I believe in it in some reason that again life doesn't bear out, and yet I guess I have hopes.
And you teach literature.
I do.
So, yeah.
I do.
So you must have some good experiences with
well,
this.
Well, I love teaching.
Indeed.
I love teaching.
Yes.
You know, I don't follow my students out into the world to see that if I see if what I've taught them has any effect. But it's very, it's a very hopeful thing to me to be with young people who will treasure the things that I treasure and entertain the questions that I think are important and love the books that I love. It's a wonderful thing. It's something that I never question the value of. Whereas I can say, you know, does the world need another book by me? They could be reading Madame Bovary or Middlemarch. Perhaps that would be better for them. But I always believe that teaching is a good and a useful thing.
I think that's true. I also think that it's really important that people read contemporary literature as well. I mean, in my ideal universe, everyone would read Middlemarch and, you know, read Pearl. But it's interesting, increasingly, as culture goes on, there's so much stuff.
So much stuff.
And you can't really, I don't expect a 16-year-old to really jump into Jane Austen necessarily. I mean, she might do better beginning with a living writer.
Yeah. Although I think wonderful teachers
can make a
14-year-old jump into Jane Austen.
Well, and some of us are drawn to that stuff, whether anyone tells us about it or not.
So. I know, you do get these, you know, my daughter was reading Pride and Prejudice, and I think probably because she was at that age like Emma, a little bit too much like Emma, but she's grown out of that. But she just came to it like a duck to water.
Yes.
At age 13 or 14.
I mean, I had that experience. I had actually terrible teachers as a young, you know.
I did, too.
I think many of us have.
I don't know how I came to it. I was just talking to somebody. You know, how did I? I had, you know, two friends who are still my dear friends, and we sort of would go to the New York Public Library and find these books. We didn't know what in God's name we were looking for. And I remember we knew that D.H. Lawrence was dirty, so that was good. But we got this book out of the library by D.H. Lawrence called Kangaroo, which was set in Australia. And then it was like, wait, where's the dirty part? So we were so naive, and yet, you know, this sort of crashing headlong into literature. And finding things.
Yeah, I think about that a lot. I mean, I guess I just sort of assume that there's still kids like that.
I think there are.
That no matter what else is going on, how many video games are available and how much internet stuff, they'll still walk up to a shelf of books and go, oh, this looks cool.
Yeah, we have to hope, and I do believe that. Maybe fewer, but as Milton says, fit audience, but few.
Yes, exactly. So what are you working on now in this?
I'm working on a book of nonfiction, which will be about my mother.
Ah.
Kind of the companion to The Shadow Man. And I'm calling it Circling My Mother. My mother was a polio victim.
That's right.
And she also had Alzheimer's for 11 years. So I'm trying to write about the doubly afflicted mother, but how to get through the images of affliction to a beloved and desirable mother, too.
Well, that's hard work, too,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
How your memoirs are so powerful, and you bring a lot of the same, you know, sort of gift for description and metaphor to your nonfiction writing.
Thank you.
Which do you prefer, or do you need to do both? Or?
I never choose. I mean, I'm just called to write a certain kind of thing, and it's not like I get a different brain to, you know, do the different forms. It just seems, that seems to be right for fiction, or that really is something I can't make a fiction of.
Right.
And so I do go back and forth in ways that I can't articulate very well.
Interesting. You do a lot of research for both. I mean, there's...
Yeah, and that's the best part. I mean, there's one level in which I could just be happy in a library with the smells of books and writing things on index cards, and then, okay, I did that. Now I don't have to write the book. That, to me, is a great joy, just getting random little bits of information and writing them down on cards and playing with them.
Yeah.
That's really fun.
As a constant reviewer, you know, I love the reading. I'm like so into it. Then I'm like, oh, well, now I have to...
I have to write something.
Can I just keep doing this?
Yes.
And can I go off on these tangents? You know, like Mary Gordon inspired me to go back to Ruskin. Can I just do that for a while?
Yeah.
As a girl, I think early on I realized how much fun that was. That's a form of wandering around and exploring.
Yes. And that's why I feel, and maybe it's just because I'm such a techno moron, but I feel like the internet doesn't do that for you because it's unsensual.
Yeah.
And that whole joy of being in a library with the smell and the crumbling pages. And I know there's serendipity on the internet, but it doesn't seem quite so embodied as, oh my goodness, that has a nice cover. I think I'll take it down. And, oh, you know, here's a whole other world that opens up to me.
Right. And there's a different kind of order. I mean, libraries, you know, are set up in a way that has to do with the books, whereas the internet, it's, you know, it can just be words. It can just be some other combination. So you spend a lot of time having to be, and maybe this is good for us, extremely skeptical. Like,
yes.
Oh, how, what is this? This
yeah.
can't be right. And so while, you know, it's very useful and, you know, being a desk jockey, I really appreciate it. I often feel, though, that I really need to go back in the library. And that sort of, you know, this is sort of art versus life again, you know, to be so in your head all the time and
yeah.
not to be walking around and not to have to carry something in your arms.
And not to be able to smell it.
To smell it.
Yeah.
yeah and look at it. And I don't know, time is different.
Yes.
There's a different, I think you think differently. And I'm aware increasingly that it's more and more going to be on the screen.
I know.
You know, it's the screen age. And so that worries me. And it also seems to go in parallel to the fact that the environment's being destroyed so that maybe none of us will be able to go outside in the future. So
yeah, and I think if
you're about that.
If you're less attached to physical reality,
yes.
you care less
yes.
what happens to physical reality. It's very frightening to me, but on the other hand, I don't basically know what I'm talking about. And so, you know, maybe there'll be a whole other way of being alive that will be great in some ways I can't predict.
Well, you know, I think about this a great deal, and I believe that because we're such adaptive creatures, that we will find beauty under any circumstance, and that we'll accept whatever we're born into and
I hope
deal
so.
With
it's
it.
It's just a little bit hard if you grew up with one notion of
yes.
beauty and you're sort of moving into middle age when another one is being formed that's not quite yours. And I think the great challenge is to not be obsessed with a kind of nostalgia for a past that never existed and to be crabby. I mean, I'm really trying not to be a crabby middle-aged person and saying, you know, ain't it awful? But it's hard when what you hold dear seems to be not valued.
Well, I agree with you completely, but I think there's a huge difference between being crabby about how terrible movies are versus how they were in the 40s versus lack of fresh water and
yes.
clean air
yes.
and animals and plants.
Oh,
I mean,
yes.
I'm not willing to give that up.
No.
And yet Western civilization seems to have decided that those are not important.
But on the other hand, the very people who are, you know, carrying on about the fact that children aren't reading Latin seem to be not bothered by toxic
yes.
waste dumps as long as, you know, somebody's making an enormous profit, which will then enable you to fund a symphony.
Right.
So, again, I always, it's nothing's ever neat. And some people who care enormously about the environment would never open a book.
Yes.
Or
and
would
actually
read
don't
stuff.
Like people all that much.
That's true.
So, I always find myself trying to figure out how to bring all this together. I mean, there's Terry Tempest Williams, for instance, writes about why don't we treat nature like art?
Yeah.
I mean, we go through enormous amounts of effort to restore old masterpieces, to mm-hmm. preserve, but we'll trash a landscape, we'll pollute a river, we'll let species go extinct.
Because I think it's about money.
Yeah.
One of the things that was very humbling to me is a guy who mows my lawn in the house that I have in the country. I had this big sign on my lawn against a Walmart being built because the Walmart would turn a horse farm into a Walmart. And this guy just said to me, but, you know, there are no jobs here.
Yes.
And,
yes.
you know, Walmart is a job and benefits. And I said, but, you know, it's a terrible job and the benefits are terrible. And he said, but we have nothing.
Yes.
And I had to shut my mouth.
Well, yes. And
so that's another thing I don't know.
Yeah, that's complicated. I mean, that's, you know, faced by fishermen and loggers.
Yeah.
And, I mean, and you know, part of me is like, well, you know, this is change is really painful and certain ways of life have been conducted so irresponsibly that you can't do them anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, not.
And yet if somebody is on welfare.
Yeah.
They're not going to, you know, that's the
right,
reality
that's
for them, and they can't afford medical care, and you can.
I know.
I find that anguishing, just completely anguishing.
It is, and it goes back to the issues of class you were talking about, too.
Yeah, and I think that's why
someone like me
people
can think about
in the
this,
red states think liberals are elitists, you know, because we care about the spotted owl, and they're not, you know, they don't. I mean, again, I think that they're not thinking well, but I understand why they're thinking that, and I understand their anger.
Oh, I do, too, completely.
But I don't know what to do about it.
They're thinking well because they're not, the education is failing.
Yeah.
It's not addressing things. So how is someone supposed to know? I mean, I know because I care, and I've had, you know, a blessed life where I can read books and
That's
think
right.
about these things. I mean, not that I don't work, but so I came to this myself, and I know it isn't taught adequately, and there's reasons for that. I mean, I think.
But we also have a blessed life because we were the ones who did well in school, which enabled us to get a certain kind of education, to do a certain kind of job. And, you know, supposing we'd been dyslexic or gone to really terrible schools or been behavior problems or had parents that just shoved us in front of a television all day.
Right.
We are so fortunate and we're so blessed. And I think that gap between people who have to do work that's awful, 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 and soul-destroying, and still don't have enough money, and have to do three jobs that are terrible, and us. It's a huge gap, and I don't know how to speak across that gap. I think Clinton could do it. I'm just hoping that somebody else will be able to do it.
Yes.
I can't.
Well, I think, though, that art and fiction often does, but, you know, how do you... Who's reading it?
Yeah.
You know, that's where you come up against that.
Yeah.
So, well, it's been really terrific.
Oh, thank you.
It's been wonderful.
Wonderful.
Thank you for listening to Open Books. We've had the great honor and the great pleasure of speaking with acclaimed novelist and memoirist Mary Gordon, mostly about her new novel, Pearl. Open Books is funded in part by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council, a state agency, and we're very grateful for that. Produced by Donna Seaman and Craig Coyes, Open Books is a public affairs program of Loyola University, Chicago.